you saw me and you're like, oh, it's okay, it's okay. I'll go again for you.
Was ist gut? Ein Podcast des Deutschen Designer Club.
In einer unserer letzten Sendungen hörten wir einen Vortrag des bekannten Soziologen und Autoren Harald Welzer, den er auf unserem Konvent für demokratisches Design in Frankfurt gehalten hat. Er sprach unter anderem auch darüber, wie wichtig es sei, dass wir lernen, Ereignisse und Entwicklungen in unserer Welt immer mehr im Zusammenhang zu betrachten. Alles hängt mit allem zusammen. Der Klimawandel mit der Migrationskrise, eine weltweite Pandemie mit Digitalisierung, soziale Ungerechtigkeit mit Gesundheit, Wasserknappheit mit Bildung oder zum Beispiel der russische Angriffskrieg auf die Ukraine mit den Brotpreisen in Kenia. Und um dieses Land geht es heute. Willkommen im DDcast. Mein Name ist Rainer Gerisch. Letzte Woche sprachen wir mit Professor Dr. Gesche Joost über die Verantwortung von Digital-DesignerInnen, ihre persönliche Ernüchterung über das Internet und die Chancen demokratischer Gestaltung. Gesche forscht mit ihrem Team unter Volldampf an Themen, mit denen unser heutiger Gast, die kenianische Architektin Etta Madete, tagtäglich ganz praktisch zu tun hat. Integrative Gestaltung, nachhaltige und zugleich bezahlbare Wohnung, Planung, die soziale Spaltung verhindern und demokratisches Miteinander ermöglichen. Die 1992 in Nairobi geborene Etta Madete ist Architektin und Projektleiterin beim großen Architekturbüro Bildix Studio in ihrer Heimatstadt. Sie entwirft, plant und managt, sie arbeitet aber auch an Finanzierung und Förderung von Großprojekten. Sie war Fellow am Aspen Institute in den USA, hat mit Rem Koolhaas zusammen geforscht und hat zahlreiche Konferenzen und Workshops zu nachhaltigem Bauen moderiert. Zurzeit promoviert sie über die Luftqualität in engen Wohnblocks unter kenianischen Bedingungen. Das Violinstück, mit dem wir diese Sendung eingeleitet haben, ist eine ihrer Eigenkompositionen, mit der sie zwischen kenianischer traditioneller Musik und westlicher Klassik vermittelt. Mein Kollege Georg Christoph Bertsch spricht mit ihr jetzt darüber, wie sie als Planerin und Architektin im rasant wachsenden Kenia unter sehr schwierigen Bedingungen vorausdenkt und wie sie dabei anderen Orientierung gibt.
Today we have Etta Madete Mukuba from Nairobi in our remote studios. How are you?
I'm good, George. Hi, good to see you again.
Yeah, it's great to see you again. So what do you see when you look out of the window?
Well, I live in a very random oasis in Nairobi where you have a beautiful little forest and a 1950s apartment block surrounded by, 20 to 15 story apartment blocks. And in this apartment block, it's just two stories. It's a very old neighborhood. It has beautiful trees. It has monkeys and birds. And we chose it because of that. And I feel like it is about to get sold off to a mega developer who will build 3,000 units on the same plot. But we're enjoying it while we can.
So you are working at BuildX Studios. So let's first talk about what BuildX actually is. So what kind of studio is BuildX?
BuildX Studio is a design, build, develop firm based here in Nairobi, Kenya. But our main anchor is in sustainable development and sustainable design. We care about social impact. So all our projects are environmentally friendly, think about sustainable design, using green buildings or innovative materials that is sort of changing the way that we build and moving the market forward. But most importantly, we believe in social impact. So the projects we work on, such as schools, hospital, and housing, is trying to make buildings and a radically better world for people and for planet. We have a department of design. So we have architects, engineers, we have quantity surveyors all under one roof. But we also have a build department. So we also build projects and have a construction department. But also we have a development side. The development side is something new. And it's because we realize that many times our clients may not have the same impact aspiration as we do. And it's almost like you're forcing it down their throat. So we decided we need to be our own clients in some of our projects. So the develop arm basically sources new projects. It searches out for financing, builds business plans and feasibilities for projects that are more radical, that are innovative, that are changing or pushing the needle for a radically better built environment. Such projects is our affordable housing project, which is about to break ground. And this project is one that we developed from business plan, sourcing, funding, all the way to sales and marketing, which we're doing now. And we're going to design, we've designed it and we're going to build it. That's just an example. But in other projects, we have been designers. So we get projects from architects and we design from clients and we design it from first principles. And in other projects, we are purely the contractors. For example, one of our more famous projects, we were the contractor and the builder for Francis Kerre's project here in Kenya, which is the last project he did before he won the Pritzker Award, which is like the Nobel Prize for Architecture. And it's here in Kenya, in Turkana, and we were the contractors. So that's basically the full range. We are a very vibrant community here in Kenya. We're about 40 staff across all the three different departments. But the key thing or the key underlying thing is social impact, environmental impact, and consciousness of the carbon effect of the built environment.
But you seem to be have a cross-functional position in the company. As far as I understand, you're working in planning and in funding, in structural strategic topics. So this is for a young architect. I think it's a very challenging task. So what you're actually doing, let's say, starting in the morning? So what is your work if you look at all these different responsibilities that you have?
Well, as an architect, your job is always fluctuating depending on what question you're trying to answer. And I think I always believe in answering a question. So for the last 3 years or 4 years, I was answering, how can you build sustainably in Kenya? So I was working on very many different projects and building feasibilities, as well as doing design and architecture and looking at projects on site. But right now, my main focus is asking, how can you build affordable housing sustainably in Kenya? So at the moment, my day-to-day is focused on our affordable housing project, Zima, and doing three things. One is in actually getting it to get built. So doing the planning approval, doing all the logistical coordination of the different teams. And then after that, the second thing I'm doing is we have a grant to document this project and open source it to the market. Because it is trying to push the boundaries of sustainability and affordability, as well as the idea of how you can build sustainably and affordably for housing is actually quite novel here. So that's the second thing I do. I'm running the case studies. It's because of my academic background. I'm a lecturer at the University of Nairobi, so I'm able to sort of put both hats on as a practical architect, but also as an academic analyzing the situation as it is happening. So it's been a project that we've had for about 2 years, and it's going to take 2 years to construct. So we're going to have several case studies published on different aspects, such as how do you ensure gender lens design? How do you involve women in construction? What are the strategies that we're going to use to ensure that this project has sustainable design? And how did we manage to make it affordable? What are the compromises we've made? So we're just answering questions as you're doing the actual practical pilot project. The third thing is that now with my developer hat on, is that affordable housing only makes sense at scale. So this pilot project, it's 137 units on half an acre. So it's a big project in itself, but it's making us almost zero profit, I'll be honest, because there's a lot of learning curves. But also in affordable housing, once you have a standardized model that you're trying to use and replicate, then once you're doing 1,000 units or 2,000 units, That's when it starts to make sense. So in parallel to getting this project off the ground, and it's almost done, we're basically breaking ground in 8 weeks. But we are also looking for the next project. That is Zima 2. And Zima 2 is going to be 1,000 units. And Zima 3 is going to be 1,500 units. So what we're doing is basically scaling up this pilot at a much larger site. But also, as a developer, you have to look at all the different nitty-gritties, the costs and the who's going to be involved. How do I make it efficient? But on the other side, I'm an architect, so I don't want a cookie-cutter block that is replicated, because that's the problem with affordable housing. It becomes this sort of concrete jungle, slummified high-rises, which just don't work at a social level. So for me, the three hats I've mentioned, the first is the practical implementation side as an architect, and the second hat as an academic, are now feeding into the next Zima project and how we can scale in a way that doesn't compromise the well-being of the people. So that's what I do on a day-to-day basis.
You mentioned that this kind of sustainable building is a novelty in Kenya. It is one thing. Then you asked several times, how do you manage to establish sustainable building in Kenya? So there are two questions involved, which I think can be combined in one big question about the communication of these projects with the different stakeholders, let's say the municipality, banks, politics, people. So this is, I think this is a very important task, actually, to be able to communicate with all these different people in their different technical languages. Is this also one of your tasks? I mean, in terms of talking to all these people?
Yes, I do a lot of talking. I attend a lot of conferences and I speak a lot. The thing about technical disciplines is that if you do not manage to share your information, it is kept within the professionals who sit on high tables, and it's not very useful for people. And that's the same thing with our idea of scale. We're not designing an affordable housing project so we can make money. We're designing it so that we can change the lives of people and also ensure that other people know what the standard of living can be at an affordable price. So there's a lot of advocacy we do, and the advocacy is powered by the pilot project information. I'll give an example, and I liked how you mentioned policies and politics. For me to get this project onto the site, it has taken me about 2 years of planning approvals and permitting and jumping through 1,000 loopholes, and our financing and our standing as BuildX is that we do not bribe, we are not corrupt. So in our political climate, it is easier just to bribe and to just push your way through. And in Kenya, you can get away with anything. But we have said, no, we're going to do it the right way. Sometimes we use different tactics. One is called the sitting duck, where we basically hire somebody who will just sit in the office until somebody makes sure that they can see the drawing. And we've documented all the different things that we've done to be able to pass a project through the permitting process without any bribery. And it costs money. And we're documenting the cost of doing things the right way in our climate. And this information is being sort of quantified and given a qualitative analysis so that other people can be able to, first of all, know what they're getting into so they're prepared when they're looking for financing and explaining the situation, but also so that the government and the policymakers and the politicians realize that they're acting as a hindrance to their own agenda. The government has a huge mandate to deliver affordable housing in Kenya. It's a huge buzzword. But the government itself is preventing private partners who are willing to work with them on delivering these affordable housing units. So advocacy, education, and sharing the information is just as important. And balancing this with key stakeholders who are also in the private sector. For example, we have a really good partnership with CAF, which is the Center for Affordable Housing Finance. It's based in South Africa, but it documents South Africa and France, and it documents affordability and housing finance across the continent. And so we're working with them to establish affordability parameters and like help us work out and work through the case study and how to present it. As well as other stakeholders like FSD, different financial institutions in the country, other partners of our financier. Our financier is called Real. They are UK-based financier on that basically look at social impact. And they also look at affordable housing, social impact investment in social in affordable housing. And so we spend, I spend a lot of time talking to people and beginning and doing advocacy. And then I spend the other half just making sure this project goes to site, making sure the future project is quite well established. Housing and real estate development is multi-sector. It has so many disciplines involved just beyond the building itself. It has the urban plan. It has master planning. It has the how do you create the right urban lungs? How do you provide the right social facilities? How do you provide the right transport infrastructure to support some of these facilities? So there's a lot of stakeholder involvement and a lot of sort of piecemeal work. I do not believe that I will answer the question I'm trying to answer in my generation. I believe I'll move the needle for the next one. So I'm a lot more patient than I was when I started. Not lazy. I just sort of accept that it's going to take some time. The best I can do is ensure that what I'm doing is acting as a good exemplar for the next person and the next person and the next person.
You just mentioned before in the beginning of your answer, you mentioned the governmental perspective. Let's say the national perspective, or let's say maybe even the continental perspective. So I would like to, let's say, through this scaling up of ZEMA 1, 2, 3. So what is, if you look at the national perspective, so what are the growth expectations in Kenya? What does this mean for the sheer quantity of built space that must be produced throughout the next years? Are there any expectations? Are there any statistics? Are there any numbers about what must be built?
So I don't have all the statistics in my head, but I have what the government wants, the government of Kenya wants to do in terms of housing. So we, their goal was to build 500,000 houses in the next, well, in 4 years for the Big Four agenda. So what has happened is that all the housing that has been that is usually produced in an annual basis in the Kenyan context is at not even 1,000. So annually, all the developers and all these big machines you see in the country don't even hit 1,000 houses. And many times those houses are majority for the upper class, or their money laundering activities for somebody just to wash their money. So it's not for the affordable housing sector either. And as I said, I don't have all this, the full range of statistics. But if we are to hit a target of what is required, and that is a 2 million housing deficit, annual deficit, even if all the developers try to build what they were supposed to build every year, we still wouldn't hit that target. So the pie of need is so high and the supply is so little. So the scaling factor is the only way to ensure that we're able to meet future targets, because current targets are completely undermet.
So from, let's say, with our impression here from Europe in recent years, it seemed that only the big agglomerations were growing and that people were leaving the countryside. I know that you've been researching on country, in the countryside report, together with Rem Koolhaas. So what does countryside mean in Kenya, and what is happening in what we would call country?
The funny thing is, George, is that when we first spoke about this, I think we were in the midst of COVID. So, and we did the research just before COVID hit. So right now it looks very different. So I think I can tell you the trajectory is that in Kenya, when we promulgated our new constitution, what happened is that a lot of the national money was that was centralized in the capital was decentralized to the different counties in the countryside. So towns and cities away from the capital had an influx of finances to be able to ensure that their infrastructure and their services, including schools, hospitals that enable that create that created that enabling environment were available. And that meant that a lot of people, yes, Nairobi or the capital cities and the other two cities, that is Kisumu on the west and Mombasa on the coast, they're the hub or the attraction of employment. Remember, in urban development employment is a key driver of people, where people live and why people choose to live where they live. So the cities are there to draw people, as you know, for employment. But as a Kenyan, the unique factor is that I have never lived or say that I am from Nairobi. If I'm asked where am I from, I'll say I'm from Gisambai in Western Kenya. But I live and work in Nairobi. So many Kenyans have deep roots in the countryside. So much so that if I don't go to the countryside or to my village in Western Kenya 3 or 4 times a year, I feel very lost. And it is a sort of like 11-hour drive or 11-hour bus ride or a 10-hour drive. So it's not near. But since I was born, I've always gone home. And my family grew up in Nairobi. We've been raised in the city. I've been raised in different countries. I spent 5 years living in Nigeria, 5 years in Italy. And every year, from whatever country we're in, my father would fly us back home. And home, not Nairobi, home, Western. And so as the generations have passed, we have invested in that home. So right now, my father is retired in Western, but he's built a very like high-end development with a gym. And he's basically investing back there because he wants to live in a certain level of comfort. So when you go to people's towns and their villages, you know, villagization per se, as Rem would put it, it's actually somewhere quite developed. The thing or the key that is missing is employment. And so for the countryside right now, and it's one of the pillars of our previous our government that's just about to hand over to a new government, was industrialization. Because if there's employment, people will move. And employment just does not mean the business centers, and people are willing to work wherever there is work. So at the moment, what that used to look like is that people used to travel back to the countryside for holidays and then come back work in the main cities. And then people retire in the village. So you find that it's a very sort of a very dynamic environment. But when COVID hit and the cities became too expensive to live in and people were able to work remotely or they lost their work. For example, a majority of the lower income people in the cities are working on, you know, labor work, and a lot of the construction work went dormant. So you find that everyone was just like, okay, I can't afford to live in Nairobi if there's no work, and the whole country shut down. So people move back home. And where is home? It is the countryside. And in the countryside, they at least have land, they have security, they can grow something. So it is not dire as it is in the city. So the countryside became alive even more. And you're finding that the reality now, or the question we keep asking people now, is that we haven't actually planned our towns for this kind of future urbanization or future development. So it's something that we need to make sure that we turn our eyes. And that's what the research we did with Rem on is that we've not been paying attention to our towns, and they've been sprawling and urbanizing and creating slums just the same way that we're trying, just the same as the situation we're trying to solve in our cities. What I do believe is that, yes, there's urbanization, but urbanization also means that the towns are urbanizing. So they're becoming like cities. Just a year ago, one of our small towns was turned into a city because of its population dynamics. So it means that if it was ignored until 2 years ago, then the city problems are still the same. So it's important to be able to pay attention to both.
So when talking about floods, because here in Germany, after this Welly flood in last year with 135 fatalities, we become very sensitive about this topic. We thought that we were very well prepared, that things like that wouldn't happen, that people wouldn't die in a flood, but it happened. And it was super tragic. So you've been working for the Architectural Association of Kenya as a council member and coordinator for flood resilience. So tell me a little bit about what this is about, what the flood topic is in Kenya, and what you've been doing there, because I think this is super important, not only here, but also, well, I'm sure that it's relevant in Kenya to really be prepared for climate change and heavier rains or droughts.
Yes. It brings me some comfort that Europe is still It brings me a lot of comfort that Europe is still suffering from dealing with floods. And I can't for the life of me understand why. Because when I talk about flood in Kenya, I basically say that we've as a human race, we have known how to deal with water since inception. It is just now that we don't know how to deal with water in our cities, in our spaces. And because of the man-made built things that we have done, we have destroyed our water ecosystems. So, of course, water is coming back and attacking us. And so in the Kenyan context, the most dire thing that is very close to my heart is that when there is a flood, what happens is that it affects the most vulnerable communities. It affects those with temporary houses or homes. It affects those with that get affected by waterborne diseases. It affects those that are in spaces where you find that they were relying on that particular farmland or agricultural land to produce subsistence for their family and also to produce food for them to sell so that they can survive another year. So a flood, a natural disaster, completely wipes out the possibility of them to be able to live comfortably inside a shelter, to be able to protect themselves against hygiene issues such as health, and then also to be able to eat. So the fact that even in that scenario, the people affected by floods are typically not the ones who caused it, causes the greatest frustration. As I said, floods in Kenya, and I don't know how it is in Europe, are caused because we have either blocked something, we have over-irrigated somewhere, we have done something man-made, because water has been flowing and working in our communities for a very long time. And what we've done is that we've become super greedy and we don't understand the full value chain. So you are in the top somewhere, irrigating a beautiful flower farm and exporting beautiful roses to Europe. And down the chain or down that water system, it could be even hundreds and hundreds of kilometers away, there's a family that can't eat, can't have shelter, and are dying because of waterborne diseases. So it is a really macro level issue, but we keep seeing it as an individual issue, like you person, don't build your house here, move it here. And I believe we're analyzing it in the wrong way. So the work we're doing with the council is to, first of all, elevate the problem because it is a macro level issue. The waterways are not designed across county lines or district lines or political centers. Waterways are designed as a natural system that starts in Cairo, connects all the way to Mozambique, and connects all the way to the coast of Kenya. So it's important that we talk to all the different stakeholders at that level. And that's what AAK is doing, Architectural Association of Kenya. But then also at the individual level, we're beginning to sensitize and educate people that if this area flooded last year, it is likely that it might flood again this year. Because what people do out of just necessity is that they just build again in the same place and suffer through the same things. So we're trying to advocate and sensitize on just where is the right place to build. And in the same light, we have built on water effectively before. So the issue is not necessarily where you build, it's how you build. So we're looking at how we can create a prototype of a flood resilient home. What materials do you use? How do you raise your building above the waterline? How do you measure the waterline when it's a dry season? And that's sort of like the initial steppings of the work. And we're hoping it's able to sort of pick up a little bit, both at the granular level, all the way at the macro level.
So this is very interesting because the entire complexity and interwovenness of the European river system is also only starting to be researched on. There's one compendium published by Clement Tockner and others, which is called Rivers of Europe, which has been published only since some years. As we know, the river systems are at least as complex as our organism. And so what you just mentioned is, you trace it back to greed, but it's also, you can also trace it back to misunderstandings, to complete ignorance, and also to stupidity in a way that we deal with water.
Indeed.
But before we come to our last question, I would like to ask a question which is really important for us at the DD Cast, is a gender topic is something in the very DNA of our work here. So working as a young woman in a predominantly male context is evidently always a challenge. We are dealing with this all the time here, diversity and gender. So is this being discussed in your context, and or how are you dealing with this gender topics in your daily work, and what are your experiences so far?
Thank you for that question. I think today is actually one of those days where I've really felt that gender gap. There's a conference that's happening. It's called the East Africa Property Investment Summit. And it's a big one for developers, a lot of talk of affordable housing. And when you step into the room, you can see, okay, there's just one woman per table and there's hundreds of people here. And then an organization that is trying to push that called WIRE. So it's an organization called Women in Real Estate. It's an association that I'm a part of. As a member and also a great advocate, basically today published a letter saying that they counted, and this conference only had 15% of the speakers were women. And they said this is unacceptable. And so that gives you an idea about the range. So the issue is systemic. It is still happening as of today. This 15% of female speakers in an organization that is spanning the entire region is kind of, to be honest, ridiculous, especially because you're talking about issues spanning the entire property and development arena. But the fact that there's an organization that is documenting this, that is calling them out, such as WIRE, is a step in the right direction. Just to give broad strokes, in Kenya, there are 8% of the registered architects in Kenya are women. 8% of the registered quantity surveyors are women. And 11% of the engineers are women. And in all of these, any female-owned firm or company usually is less than 3%. So even if at the moment there's a lot of talk of, oh, there's so many women in construction now, there's a lot of push. It's not. It's because the women that are there are trying to advocate and they're trying to push. And in this same scenario, you find that, for example, when I go to site or I go to a client meeting, the first thing, the first question I'm asked is that, do you want to help me serve tea? And I'm like, wait, I'm actually the construction manager. I'm in charge of the site and I'm basically the person who hired you. So there's still this sort of mental perception that women have their place. And if you're not a strong woman who stands firm and ensures that, you know what, I'm not going to be the loud shouting feminist, but I'm going to make it clear that it's important that you know how to address these issues, it's not going to change. So we are making good progress. There's the scale of the fact that it's a systemic issue. And there's also the other side where there's a lot of effort in trying to make sure that there's female representation, but it's still a far cry from what it should be. The construction industry in Kenya is, let's just say, extremely male dominated. And it's not even about, females don't want to do it. The issue is that they shouldn't. And that's the first step that we need to get through, is that women can build, women can be in technical courses. And that means educating both men and women, because women are the ones who raise these men. Women are the mothers of these men, the sisters and the brothers. So they've also ingrained in their minds that this is what a woman should do, this is what a man should do. And so that perception is changing, but at a very slow rate and almost exclusively in urban areas. The rural areas and the countryside is almost, it's even harder. There's some great organizations. I'm a great advocate for a website called Landesa, which is basically documenting land rights and home ownership in Kenya. In Kenya, for example, 1.5% of all land titles are under women's name. So basically, 1.5% of all the land is owned by women. which is crazy because you're 50% of the population. So Landesa is basically documenting this and educating women. And in this fact, when it comes to land ownership and home ownership, for me, it is an issue with women not having the right information. Because Kenya has wonderful policies when it comes to marriage rights, land registration. It's just that these policies are not translated to the right audience. And the people making these policies don't want it to be translated because, you know, it might not benefit them. So it's the same thing. We have an amazing constitution. We have an amazing requirements when it comes to women. But how do you implement this? How do you translate this? Sometimes I say, how come our construction drawings are not in the local language? How do we expect that other people can be able to build what we're saying if it's in English? So it's sort of like, how do you translate this information and this jargon and this technical information to people who really need to use it? At BuildX, our sister company, BuildHer, trains women in construction and is also sort of pushing that needle forward. But also we have quotas. For example, we need to have 50% women on site. And when you have that kind of quota, you look for the women to make sure that they're on site. But if you don't look for that quota, you'll find that the women won't even approach the site because they know that they won't get accepted. So it's both top down, making sure you have the right checklist, that you're able to make sure that you're following some form of rule to make sure that you have the rules in place, but also bottom up to provide them the tools and the resources to feel brave enough to know that this is their right. They have a right to work. They have a right to some of these technical courses. And just because you're a woman doesn't mean you can't do something.
Oh, thank you very much for this very programmatic answer. This was just much more than a personal statement. It was a kind of a political pamphlet in a way. So thank you very much. So now we must come, as you know, the subtitle of DDCast is What is Good? So we must get to the last question, short question. I think it's a very specific one. So what is good? What is good?
What is good in Kenya? What is good in
wherever
the world?
Wherever you want to have it. You can answer very openly. So it's no restriction to this question.
I believe the whole world now knows what sustainable is. So as somebody who's been training in this for 10 years and usually in the very beginning, it was almost like, what is that? What are you doing? Why? Especially in the Kenyan context. Right now, everyone knows what it is and they want to do it, even if they want to do it in a weird and dodgy and sort of undercutting way. Sustainable climate change is no longer a thing that is pushed under the rug or done for face value. It is a very serious thing and that is good. That is good. It has reached Nairobi. It has reached the rural areas of Nairobi. People know how to be sustainable and they know that if they're not doing it, they'll be called out. So that's what's good.
Super. So thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk to you. I think it was very informative also to for our listeners. And hopefully you will just go your way because it sounds like as if you've got great plans.
You just have
you
to
know
try.
How to achieve that.
You have to try.
Okay. So thank you very much. Farewell.
All right. Bye, George.
Das war Georg im Gespräch mit Etta Madete. Etta zeigt, dass es nicht leicht ist, unter den schwierigen Bedingungen eines klimatisch gepeinigten Landes, das rasant wächst und massive Neubauprojekte braucht, Nachhaltigkeit ins Zentrum zu rücken. Sie macht aber auch klar, dass es keine Alternative dazu gibt und dass in ihrem Land sehr gute Leute sehr hart daran arbeiten, die Zukunft zu gestalten. Nächste Woche reden wir mit Hella Jungerius, die als eine der erfolgreichsten und renommiertesten internationalen Designerinnen gelten darf. Von ihr erfahren wir viel über ihre Faszination an Farben, Materialrecycling und nachhaltiges Kollektionsmanagement in Großkonzernen sowie ihre tägliche Freude am Entwerfen. Wir freuen uns auf ein Wiederhören, auch in der kommenden Woche. Bis dahin, alles Gute, eure DDCast-Redaktion.